This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Welcome back, everybody. Yes, how can one follow the blood scrunge? What? Yes. Oh, dear. Yeah, worms and slugs and things and eating the microphone, which the people on the podcast fortunately won't be able to see. Well, the only... No. So the only possible way to follow this, I guess, is with our other reader for this evening, is Mr. Ken Shin.
The tale I'm going to read tonight is not from Killer Bees from Outer Space, that great anthology, but another great anthology called Teeming Terrors from the same fine people at Nightwatch Press, end of advert. And basically, well, I don't think Nick needs to apologise for voices because this whole story is from American viewpoints and my American accents aren't brilliant, but I'll probably try them anyway. This is a story of invention, it's a story of food, it's a story of hubris, and it's a story of unpleasant death. And it's called, without further ado, Dying Inside. I'm 25 years old, I'm a world-famous celebrity, I'm a multi-millionaire. My restaurant, Beetle Bums, has a 5-year waiting list, and I'm renowned as one of the greatest innovators in the business. Right now, I'd trade all of that in for one good night's sleep. Do you really know what I enjoyed the most of all? The fame, the recognition. Anyone with a half-decent idea can get rich, but it takes talent and real drive to come face to watch and remember. When I walked down the street, people used to point and gulp. They'd ask me for autographs. If anyone tells you that they wouldn't want that, then in my humble opinion, they're lying through their teeth. Everyone wants to be a star. If I were to walk down the street today, well, I'd still point and gulp, but not in gleeful awe, more in horror and perverse sympathy. That poor man, what could possibly have happened to him? Yeah, I'd be recognized all right in entirely the wrong way. It's just not fair. As well as being famous, I also used to be damn good looking. It's not often that a celebrity chef looks like a male model with an athlete's body, but I did. If you were philosophically inclined, then you might be moved to observe that my current state is a definite case of cosmic justice. Or maybe you'd say that instant karma, just at water, had most certainly got me. Or you might smirk about it being ironic, don't you think, and then giggle at your pathetic little outdated pop culture witticism. And there'd be some truth in all of those. But do you know what it really is? Agony. Constant, relentless agony. I need to tell my story while I still have time. I'm not entirely sure if I am dying, but I'm damn well not healthy, and I'll tell it in private. I couldn't take the looks of some morbidly fascinated interviewer or some car crash connoisseur of a number one fan. Like I said, I was devilishly handsome. If I'm going to die in agony, then I'd prefer to do it with some tiny shred of dignity still intact. Excuse me. Another coughing fit. They're coming thicker and faster each day. I can feel the constant scratching in my gullet, like I've been swallowing brambles. When I spit in my monogrammed handkerchief, there are visible threads of blood, and there seem to be a little more each time. I don't care. I dose myself mercilessly with painkillers and Gentleman Jack. Yeah, how dare I? How very fucking unhealthy. Like I'm worried about that anymore. My name is Denny Ladybird, a dumb but memorable name that my parents gave me, along with a good old-fashioned upbringing and education that inspired me to believe in myself and make my own destiny. My mom and dad were both very successful professionals, and they encouraged me to do what they'd done, find something that I loved, and then do it as best I could. I flirted with various things throughout my grade school years. Artist, quarterback, astronaut. Some of them downright impractical, some I just didn't have the right stuff to succeed at. It was home economics class at the age of 10 when the magic finally happened. After just a few weeks' lessons, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to cook the best food in the world and the most original. It had to not only delight, but surprise those who ate it. One night, I told Mom and Dad that I was doing the cooking that evening, and I served up a dish of lamb ribs marinated in chili and lime, with sides of buttered eggplant, roasted yams, and a nettle and cauliflower salad. When the folks proclaimed it delicious, and I could see that their pleasure wasn't just their humouring me, they were never big on pointless mollycoddling anyway, I knew that my path was clear. Over the next 7 years, I developed and refined my skills, experimenting with more and more unusual ingredients, discarding what didn't work, which was unsurprisingly little. My talent for this was natural. Improving what I did, and always restlessly looking for the new. When I left high school, I announced to the folks I planned on opening my own eatery in Hollywood and asked them for startup money. A lot of it. But they had the cash, they had faith in my abilities, and they were happy to oblige. Inside the next year, I'd scouted out a small but decent restaurant building for sale up in the hills, purchased it, refitted its kitchen, dining room, and bar, hired a small but reliable staff, and set myself up as head chef. And then started working hard. Damn hard. The area isn't short on eating holes, so I had to make mine stand out. Through a combination of relentless publicity, some handy contacts, and constant innovation, I did. By the time that I'd hit 20, I'd already paid off my parents and made my first extra million. Plenty of rich, satisfied customers were spreading the word and coming back for more. I arranged for expansion work and a complete revamping which doubled the size of Beetle Bums, a deliberately odd and memorable name plus a nod to my own family name, making it a gaudy, splendid jewel in the Hollywood crown. I hired more staff, I became a bigger success, and I kept on inventing. Swordfish fillet with blackcurrant and mushrooms, slow-roasted beef with samphire and courgette flowers, oysters with vanilla and salsify. More and more variations and more success. Oh, and I had help. As much as good chefs, I employed good ideas people to keep the digestive juices flowing, which in turn led to the fateful day that changed everything. My good buddy Lewis and I were having one of our famous brainstorming sessions, just the two of us in a sunny private office, a plate of canapes and a bottle of Grey Goose. Lewis had always been a big fan of desserts, and they were very much on his mind that Friday morning. "What we really need on the menu," he said firmly, "is the ultimate red velvet cake." You could hear the capital letters in his voice. "You ever hear the red velvet cake story, Dan?" I hadn't, and I asked him to expand. The story isn't that long or that funny, almost certainly an urban legend. Woman eats said cake in a fancy restaurant, loves it, asks if she can have the recipe. Said restaurant sends her the recipe, but charges her big bucks for the privilege. She gets pissy and, as revenge, starts handing out copies of the recipe for free, presumably ruining the diner's big business somehow. All pretty uninspired. But what really got Lewis excited wasn't the story, so much as the idea of dessert that good. "We should make the greatest version of that cake ever, Den. And you know what? We should give out the recipe for free. It wouldn't hurt our business. It might even make us the subject of our own urban legend, which also happened to be both true and complimentary." Lewis was hard to refuse when he's enthusiastic, and that he certainly was. And the idea of making such a famous dish did appeal to my, hell, let's call it what it is, vanity. So we set about making the ultimate red velvet cake a reality. We gathered all of the variant recipes for it that we could find, took the best from all of them, and produced a hybrid which was perfect in almost all respects. The texture, the taste, the moistness, everything about it was an orgasm on the end of your fork. Just one thing lacking. The redness. Shit, give me a moment, the pain's really kicking in again. Most of the time my self-medication keeps me down to an ever-present ache and itch all over my body, but they're really getting down to business now. I swear I can feel them scratching in my fucking veins. That's not possible, is it? God, I hope it's not. More pills, more bourbon, more dry sobs, more blood. Get used to it. I'll try to keep my cool here. A few minutes, the medicine should calm things down again. So, the ultimate red velvet cake. Lewis and me spent months trying to get that color just right. Strawberries, tomatoes, even raw meat. They all produced interesting results, at least, but none of them produced that raw, glossy, fresh from Dracula's victim blood red that I was looking for. By now, though, this had become a minor obsession for us, so rather than do the sensible thing and give it up, we decided to carry on. So in that regard, what's happened to me is both our faults. However, it was Lewis who finally cracked it, and in my regard, my fate is entirely that damn idiot's fault. About 6 months ago now, he strode into my office with a shark's grin and a bottle of Dom Perignon rather than the usual Grey Goose. He clunked the bottle down on my desk with a flourish, like he just made a winning move against Kasparov. "Karshineel," he smiled. "Bless you," I shot back. "Karshineel, you imbecile. It's the answer to our prayers for the ultimate red. Don't tell me you've never heard of Karshineel." As it turned out, I hadn't heard of it, kind of, sort of. I was aware of the food coloring called Karshineel, but I'd always just had it pegged as an artificial ingredient. Lewis was quick to set me straight. proper cochineal is named for its source, a little insect. Looks a lot like a beetle, but has a much softer shell. They thrive on cacti, one kind, the nopal, in particular. And properly rendered, they produce a dye as rich and vibrantly red as Mae West's lipstick. It seemed as though our problems were solved, but they were only just starting. The little bastards need to be farmed in huge numbers to get results, especially since only the female cochineal really makes the good stuff. For the best cochineal, you need the nopals and lots of them. And you also need to have the means to render the critters, which involves drying them out in a suitable oven. But we had the money, we had the technology, and we wanted that cake. Besides, having my own site cochineal farm seemed kind of cool. And so we set one up. It involved a fair bit of work, finding the best ground, composting it properly, ensuring steady climatic conditions, and importing a shedload of nopal plants and cochineals and their eggs. But a few months later, we had everything in place and ready to go. Feeling like pioneers, we harvested our first batch of cochineals, sent them onto the happy hunting ground in the oven, and put their mortal remains to work in our recipe. When it came out of the cooker, it was as scarlet as a fire truck, almost seemed to glow red. We sliced into it, the colors stayed true all the way through. We tasted it, and the stuff was so damn good it was probably addictive. Thanks to the cochineals, we finally had the ultimate red velvet cake. Success was all but insured. I made it a certainty by plugging the cake in every newspaper ad, every TV spot and interview, every radio promo. When the Rubes tasted it, they loved it and spread the word even further. Every portion was served with a gratis copy of the recipe. No such thing as bad publicity. We were getting so much good publicity that it was almost criminal. Beetlebum's waiting list grew by another 8 months by the end of the first 3 weeks of putting it on the menu. Even by my standards, I had scored a palpable hit. Fuck, wait. The blood's running into my eyes again. Hard to concentrate with blood in your eyes. Careful here. Take out the medicated tissue, slowly. Dab at the skin around the eyes, slowly. Try not to open any fresh injuries, slowly. As you can probably guess, shaving's been out of the question for me for quite a while now. What with the scraggy beard and the medicated tissues, I'm starting to understand how hard fucking Hughes felt. How can I go on like this, I hear you ask? Simple. I'm famous. I can't die. Celebrities never really die. That's what I repeat furiously to myself every time that fresh blood oozes from another paper-thin patch of undamaged skin. My mantra. Lewis, poor dear fucking idiot that he was, wasn't famous. He put a bullet through his own brain last Friday night, left a note to me apologizing. In all fairness, this wasn't entirely his fault. He may have had the original idea, but it was me who developed it and carried it on and on to the bitter end. I did weep when I heard the news. Guess what? Agony. Literal salt in the wounds. How's that for punishment? I can't even fucking cry if I want to. The cake was so much of a success that I went a bit cochineal happy. I was just so fascinated by that rich, vibrant colour. It felt like the colour of joy, the colour of life. Not the colour of money, true, but that was a secondary consideration. I started adding cochineal to a lot of my dishes. Gumbos, curries, stews, tempuras, roasts, salads, and more desserts, obviously. The glace du diable, as I christened the new cochineal enhanced sundae, was almost as big a hit with the clientele as the cake itself. They couldn't get enough of the red stuff, it seemed, so I took steps to expand our little farm. Supply had to meet demand. It was around this point that Lewis started to express a few reservations. Mild ones, certainly, but he made it clear that he'd been thinking about things and started to feel a tad guilty about ever suggesting the cochineals to me. Killing cows, sheep, chickens, fish for food, he was fine with that. But he argued cochineals aren't food animals. Just look at it this way. We're just using them just as an optional extra then. The more I think about it, the more I regret having suggested them. Surely we could find an alternative. Chemistry can work wonders. I thought that he was being dumb and I told him as much. However, we did start to research alternative food colourings to the bugs. Naturally, we kept serving up the cochineal coloured dishes to the customers. They were a big success. And I wasn't going to replace them unless we had a completely satisfying substitute. It soon became clear once more that the idea wasn't going to fly. Vegetable replacements, meat byproduct replacements, chemical replacements, none of them worked. The colouring would be too light, too dark, too matte, too glossy. The taste would be non-existent, or chemical, or just plain mismatched. Only the critters themselves would do. Eventually, even Lewis shrugged philosophically and bowed to the inevitable. I gave him a 20 grand bonus and a brand new Testarossa, bright eye-scorching red, of course, as a consolation prize, and he became a lot happier about the whole matter. And the Carcineal fever continued. Gossip columnists started to call me Beetle Man, and tabloid cartoonist Julie made me over into a superhero, which I'll admit gave me genuine glee. The cake's recipe went on spreading, making Beetle Bums even more of a household name than it had been. When I turned up for the latest Broadway premiere, I strode up the carpet resplendent in a tailor-made free piece that glowed under the camera flashes with the brilliant red of thousand upon thousand of cochineals. I've often wondered if, due to the sheer hubris involved, that was somehow the turning point. Oh yeah, I admit that they knew what they were doing. Individually, they may well be dumber than mud, but when you start learning a bit more about hive minds, you do find yourself starting to wonder. What was it Huxley once said? When the individual feels, the community reels. Seems kind of fitting. It only sounds crazy until something happens that makes you question what you thought you knew. Hang on, more coughing. I hack up more blood in between fits of swearing. I'm sure I can definitely see them moving back and forth. I'm sure of it. It's not a hallucination. Remember all those tired old uses of skin crawling to describe horror movies? It's a literal truth to me. And a lot of them must be female. Female means eggs. Eggs means more of them. Sure, a lot of them won't last long, but the sheer weight of numbers is going to tell. My whole body is a kingdom at war. I'm losing. It was just over 2 months ago that the breaking point was reached. I often try to put myself into their mindset, frequently sneering at myself for being so credulous, then reminding myself of all the evidence to the contrary. In my darker moments, I wonder if I saw it as some sort of rebellion against a cruel and unjust God. Lewis and me had been farming the cochineals intensively. They chew through nopals, stunned themselves, bred, laid eggs. We harvested them, threw them into the ovens by the tray, and went back for more. With their habitat perfected, the bugs became the gift that just kept on giving. Supply and demand wasn't the problem. In addition to the ones that we selected to become our latest taste sensations, we were killing thousands more just to keep their numbers in check. Insects breed fast, another evident truth which had become painfully obvious. It was a glorious August morning, and we were strolling among the cacti groves. We were pretty much alone, most of the pickers being on their break. I lit up a Romeo e Juliet and inhaled luxuriously. Life was good, but Lewis appeared to be having another one of his little crises of conscience. Dan, I know that these little bastards are making us a fortune, but we've already got a fortune. I know that they're making us bigger than Elvis, but we weren't exactly unknowns, were we? And we keep on merrily burning them alive in their droves. Look, I know that bugs ain't exactly the sort of thing to get the morons of Peter up in arms, but doesn't it bother you even slightly that we're mass slaughtering something that doesn't even need to be? So there's no decent substitute. Have you considered, oh, I don't know, just taking them off the menu and finding something new to pull in the crowds? Innovation is what we're supposed to be all about. He was harshing my buzz. Sometimes you have to lay down the law even with your best friends, and this was one of those times. Lewis, stop talking crap. May I remind you once more that this was originally your idea? It's way too late to get cold feet now. In addition, these little guys are real crowd pleasers. Why fix something that ain't broke? How's that good business sense? This is a business, in case you'd forgotten. And why get the bleeding heart over a mess of bugs? It's not like we're mass roasting kittens and puppies here. The things probably don't even know they've been cooked until it's already happened. They're a restaurateur's dream come true. Bigger profits, bigger crowds, bigger fame, and no unpleasant aftertaste. We halted among a large stand of nopals. Great swarms of cochineals were roaming back and forth over them, burrowing into the soft pulp, clambering over each other, eating, breeding, making us more and more profits. I moved closer to the cacti, gesturing at the crawling masses. Look at them. They're stupid, and they're probably as happy as a bug can be. The more that we use them in our dishes, the brighter our future gets, and who's a good goddamn about that? Rendering them gets us more and more, and as for cooking and eating them, they're no great loss. And that was when Lewis, poor guilty fool that he was, made the move that changed everything. He grabbed hold of my shoulder and shoved me hard, presumably trying to add weight to whatever point he was about to make. I wasn't expecting it, and clearly he hadn't thought it through. As he shoved, he stumbled badly on an uneven paving under our feet, and the two of us smashed down to the middle of the cluster of nopals, landing heavily in an awkward mesh of thrashing limbs. The fight wasn't even a fight over almost as soon as it began. As we struggled back to our feet, brushing clumps of cochineals off of our clothes, Lewis was stammering out an apology. It had all been a heat of the moment thing, he said. He was taking things too seriously, he said. This won't happen again, he said. He was obviously on the verge of crapping himself. You don't just launch yourself at someone like me and expect to get away with it. But he needn't have worried. Like I say, he was a good friend. I wasn't going to fire him over a silly little incident like this. Frankly, I was more preoccupied with spitting cochineals out of my mouth, blowing them out of my nostrils, and brushing the mirror to be off of my hands and face. The tickling on my skin was a real annoyance, and clearly it was for Lewis as well. We spent long moments frantically swatting ourselves down. Then we caught each other's eyes and laughed. It was all so damn ridiculous. The only downside was that we both spent the rest of the day scratching. The cochineals had really infested our clothing, all the way down to the skin. Even a change of outfits didn't help. They'd swarmed us, and were caught in our hair, our nostrils, our ears. But they were more of an irritant than anything else. A good shower that evening, we'd be ready to rock once more. I closed up for the night, shared a reconciliatory drink and a joke with Lewis, and we headed for home. As I stripped of the shower in my penthouse apartment, my eye was caught by a stippling red rash that covered pretty much all of my body. Closer inspection in the mirror showed it was over my face, too. Fine red dots, tiny enough to escape a casual glance, but obvious if you took a careful look. Probably an allergic reaction of some sort, I figured, and took a scaldingly hot cleansing shower. Feeling spruce and refreshed, I poured myself a generous final nightcap and slipped between the sheets. That night's sleep was decidedly rough. I kept awakening, feeling itchy and discomforted. I was convinced that there were fleas in my bed. I looked long and hard, but saw nothing, just that damn rash on my skin. That was itching, and I scratched it irritably. My nails must have needed manicuring because I opened several small scratches on my face and arms. I swabbed the small amounts of blood, applied antiseptic, swallowed some Ambien, and managed a couple of hours fitful sleep before the alarm awoke me. I checked myself in the bathroom mirror. Was it my imagination, or did the rash look more inflamed? I couldn't be sure. Whatever it was, it clearly wasn't an excuse for laying off work. I'd only just settled down at my desk to peruse the latest trade magazines over a large black label when there was a knock at the door. I bade the caller enter. It was Lewis. His exposed hands and face were covered with tiny red dots. As soon as he saw me, he smiled thinly. "Snap," he declared. I put the trays aside as he sat down, pouring himself a stiff drink without asking. "If you've had the same experience as me, you've hardly slept," he stated bluntly. "Do you think that it's something to do with the cochineals?" "Could be," I mused. "Some sort of allergy, I guess. A bit painful, but probably nothing serious. Give it a few days and some calamine lotion, we'll be laughing. You'll see." A week later, and we weren't laughing. The rash just kept getting worse, and taking a shower was becoming an ordeal. Our skin seemed to be a lot thinner. We kept opening up paper-cut-like wounds. Small, healed quickly, but bled more than you'd expect, and with a lot of pain. Something was obviously wrong. I pulled a few strings and booked Lewis and myself in with the best doctor in Beverly Hills. We underwent a barrage of tests, x-rays, blood samples, urine samples, the works, and thorough physical checkups. Damn, I hate proctological examinations. I paid handsomely to ensure that the results were prioritized. Whatever this was, we had to know. It was affecting our work, and no way could I be seen as the public face of beetle bums looking like I did now. It took another week before we were called back to the docks. Things were still getting worse. Lewis and me looked like a couple of ripe strawberries in human form. Our skin was an unhealthy scarlet, pocked with smaller crimson marks like seeds. Despite the heat of the day, we'd entered the surgery with collars pulled up and sunglasses in place, gloves covering our bleeding hands. When we removed those, the doc looked at once appalled, yet unsurprised. He motioned us to sit, put on his best solemn look, and informed us that he had very odd and very bad news. It was when he showed us the x-rays that I felt the bottom of my guts drop out. The slide showed what could only be called a large, foggy mass in all four of our lungs, extending wispier trails up our throats. My initial thought was cancer, but it was immediately clear that wasn't it. Cancer that extensive, we'd already be dead. What the fuck was this? I looked at Lewis and saw his anger and fear mirroring mine. Then our kindly medic explained the further evidence from our blood tests. What he was saying had to be some sort of sick joke. Insectile matter in our bloodstreams? The masses in our lungs were shifting? That sounded impossible, until he showed us the changing shapes in successive slides. His best diagnosis was both informed and useless. "It's what I can only describe as an insect infestation of your bodies. Certain parasitic insects would be an immediate parallel, but this isn't anything parasitic as far as I can determine. You're obviously not losing weight. All of the chemicals that should be present in your body are there in full, apart from the iron. Blood loss has lessened that slightly. Whatever it is, there's nothing that I can realistically do to help. Radiation or chemical treatments might help, but they'd also be so intensive by necessity that they'd kill you. Surgery might be possible, but this infestation is so thorough and so pervasive that, again, such surgery would kill you. I must admit, I am astonished by your condition. Do you have any idea of what might have caused it? Are you in regular contact with any dangerous insects? Cochineals, you idiot, I snapped. Don't you know who I am? I was about to add more when a sudden fit of coughing seized me. A violent one. I hacked and barked for a good 15 seconds before I caught my breath. Reflexively, I spat into my handkerchief, and that was when I saw the first threads of blood, and also the small, squirming insect that had come with them. That was when I started to scream. We did go back to him once more to see if we'd somehow been dreaming. He told us that we hadn't. He told us that he couldn't give us any idea how severely our internals had been compromised or of how our life expectancy might be affected. We could live out our full lifespan with appropriate medication, he said encouragingly. Then he asked us whether we might want to leave our bodies to science. We didn't go back again. That was over 4 weeks ago, and things got worse for both of us fast. Personal grooming out of the window was the least of our worries. Lank, greasy hair and scruffy facial hair became inevitable once we learned that the cochineals were, in many places, just below our skin. These little bastards have mouths designed to carve through cacti. Chewing through human flesh may not be nutritious for them, but they can do it. Even though they can only be getting the barest of nutrients in highly inhospitable conditions, they survive long enough to do damage, and like I said, to breed. And some of the newborns will survive, possibly adapt that a little bit more, and carry on the cycle. They dug into our skins, they rushed down our windpipes into our lungs, and they weren't going anywhere. The coughing fits came thicker and faster. We had difficulty breathing. The terrible itching below our skins grew steadily worse. We desperately tried to resist scratching, succumbing at last only to watch helplessly as our ever more brittle skin split under our fingers and fresh blood oozed forth. More and more, we saw those tiny wriggling forms every time that we spat. Lewis swore that near the end, he could feel them crawling inside his eyelids. I really don't want to think about that. What else could it be? It has to be a hive intelligence. These things should just curl up and die where they are now, but they don't. They want to survive, at least long enough to exact retribution. There's no other explanation. I massacred them, and now they want to return the favor. It wouldn't be so bad if they did it quickly. At least when they went to the ovens, they can at most have had a vaguest moment of agony before they popped like corn. But like Doc Hollywood said, my lifespan may not even be significantly reduced by them. My quality of life, however, most certainly can. And now Lewis is gone. Whatever life is left to me, it's going to be a constant assault of torment and agony. Fuck! 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 Oh, God. That was a really bad one. I cough, examine my spittle. There are more of the cochineals each time, stirring feebly, dying, but having played their part. Without thinking, I wearily slump my head into my hands. My nails tear fresh strips of skin from my temples, and the blood gushes quickly. I awkwardly fumble an antiseptic dressing into place, fastening it clumsily with untrimmed fingernails. I carefully pour another large JD, chase down 4 more codeine tablets. I light another Chesterfield and inhale the smoke vengefully. I chain smoke now, 60 a day average plus cigars. Doesn't smoke kill insects? Even if I can't be cured, I can accept some sort of petty payback. Small pleasures stave off suicide? I hope. Some hope. Sooner or later, the balance of pain versus stubbornness is probably going to tip in favor of the former, and that's when I'll really hit the pills. But I've got to hang on. So help me, I love beetle bums, and I want to stay in charge of it for as long as I can. I have taken cochineal off the menu, though. Not remorse, don't misunderstand me. Just don't want to risk what's happened to me happening to anyone else. The humiliation of an expensive public lawsuit is something that I intend to avoid, come what may. So, now you know my story. Promise me one more thing. Don't release it into the public domain until after I've died, okay? Grant me that one small, final dignity. What? Do I have any regrets? Listen, I'm proud of what I've achieved in my life. I've only got one regret. I really, really wish that we decided to create the perfect wattle of salad instead. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. We'll now take a short break while everybody goes for a shower. And then we will come back and have the usual Q&A.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.